Pakistan has to begin the process of changing its relationship with the Akani Network and with others.
Concerns are raised about Pakistan's stability. It's Monday, December 18th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, assessing Rohingya casualties, trying to talk with North Korea, Tibetans seek Indian citizenship, new tobacco ads, robot fish swimming in Italy. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for an attack on a crowded church in Quetta, southwestern Pakistan, on Sunday. At least two heavily armed suicide bombers assaulted and killed at least nine worshippers from the minority Christian community at the Bethel Memorial Methodist Church, located in a highly secured central part of the city. Witnesses said two of the assailants wanted to enter the main hall where around 400 worshippers were attending Sunday service. But police guards at the main gate engaged the attackers, killing one of them and leading the second to blow himself up outside the hall. The provincial police chief told reporters the death toll could have been in the scores had the timely action by police guards on duty not stopped the bombers from entering the church hall. Just last week, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson expressed concern about the stability of Pakistan given the presence of so many terrorist organizations that have found safe haven in the South Asian nation. He said they are growing in size and influence and warned Islamabad it may become the target of their attacks.
They may turn their attention from Kabul and decide they like Islamabad as a target better. We want to work with Pakistan to stamp out terrorism within their boundaries as well. But Pakistan has to begin the process of changing its relationship with the Akani Network and with others. I understand that this is a relationship that has emerged probably for, in their view, good reasons a decade ago, but now that relationship has to be altered because if they're not careful, Pakistan is going to lose control of their own country.
Tillerson said the United States wants to work with Pakistan, including information sharing, but he said the status quo of providing safe haven for terrorists cannot continue. Michael Kugelman is senior associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty there is a disconnect between what the United States sees against Pakistani denials that terrorists find safety within its borders.
I think that trying to bridge that divide is really one of the many challenges in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. But I think what's clear is that the Trump administration really does mean business in ways that the Obama administration did not. I think that the Trump administration is signaling here that it's willing to take matters into its own hands, perhaps, if Pakistan does not crack down against these terror groups that target Americans in Afghanistan.
Mr. Tillerson did say that he wanted to find common ground to promote peace in neighboring Afghanistan. Is that possible?
Well, it'll be really difficult. I think that, you know, the U.S. government acknowledges that to have some type of peaceful settlement to the war in Afghanistan, Pakistan will need to be involved. It's because Pakistan is seen as having a significant influence and leverage over the Taliban. And if there's any hope of getting the Taliban to agree to a peace process or to a reconciliation process, Pakistan, with the leverage it has, would need to be the one to essentially compel the Taliban to come to the peace table. The question, though, is whether Pakistan is able to do that, or even if it would want to do it. And, of course, beyond that, the bigger question is if the Taliban would have any interest in sitting down to a peace process. I think in all these questions, the answers are very unclear.
Mr. Tillerson said Pakistan has to begin the process of changing its relationship with the Haqqani Network and with others. What is that relationship?
At the very least, Pakistan provides safe spaces to the Haqqani Network and to the Afghan Taliban leadership, meaning that the leaders of these organizations are able to live and operate freely within Pakistan. And beyond that, you know, it's sort of unclear what type of relationship there is. I mean, there certainly are some analysts that argue that Pakistan provides weaponry and other types of material support to the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani Network. I think it's hard to say exactly what nature of this relationship is, but at the very least, and this is a problem, Pakistan provides safe havens to these groups. It provides them a space to essentially shield themselves from what's going on in Afghanistan. And, you know, rule 101 about insurgency is that so long as an insurgent organization enjoys a cross-border sanctuary, it's going to survive. And that's one reason why the Taliban has really remained so strong over the years, despite all these years of war fighting on the part of the U.S. and its allies in Afghanistan.
Michael Kugelman said Pakistan has not seen the Haqqani network and the Afghan Taliban as threats, yet other terrorist groups have targeted Pakistan, and by their very nature, such groups are prone to change allegiances. He cautioned that harsh U.S. actions, such as imposing targeted sanctions against Pakistani military and intelligence officials for their alleged ties to terrorists, could result in Pakistani retaliation, including the shutting down of NATO supply routes and cutting off intelligence sharing. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Taliban kills 14 Afghan troops. Suicide car bomb targets NATO convoy. Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh unprotected from cold winter ahead. Trio lift off from Kazakhstan, head for space station. China unveils clean heating plan as shortages continue. Steak in Vietnam's top brewer for sale, but bids few. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Last week, we reported Doctors Without Borders said at least 6,700 Rohingya Muslims were killed in the first month of a brutal army crackdown on Rohingya rebels. The Geneva-based international aid group says it came up with its estimate after conducting a survey of several Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh. We wanted to learn more, so VOA's Sarah Williams spoke with Sydney Wong, the medical director for Doctors Without Borders in Amsterdam, about the findings.
What we know is that around the time of August the 25th, the Myanmar military, police and local militia launched what we consider the latest clearance operations in Rakhine in response to the attacks by the Rakhine Rohingya Salvation Army on these police posts.
Your organization says there were at least 6,700 Rohingya killed. How were you able to calculate the amount of casualties contained in this report?
Yeah, so what we did was we performed a standard tool that we use and we have a good level of experience in, and these are called retrospective mortality surveys. And what we do is we randomly select a large number of households, which are spread across the refugee settlements in Bangladesh. And of these selected households, we ask the head of the household to report on any deaths to family members during a time period. And that time period was between May to the end of October. And we also verify that information. So we ask the head of the household if there was a death reported. We ask when that death was, the location, and what they believe to have contributed to that death. And as usual with mortality surveys, we can then do some statistical analysis on the reported information. And from this, that's how we estimate mortality rates and the total number of deaths for the population that we surveyed.
Yeah, because there's a large discrepancy between these figures and then the estimates that were given by Myanmar officials.
There is. I mean, it's not my place or the organization's to comment on how those figures were collected. I think what we can say is the surveys that we did and the as you said, the staggeringly alarming results that we found from our own surveys.
What kind of violence was reported by the victims?
Overall, in terms of the reported deaths, we had 70% that were reported due to violence. And of those 70%, the majority that were reported were due to gunshots. A number were due to beatings. And unfortunately, we heard some horrific stories of reported deaths where people were burnt alive in their own houses. So there were just some terrible stories that we heard.
And apparently there were children as well were victims.
Exactly. That's what we found also extremely upsetting, that the percentage of deaths from children, a large number of them were also reported due to violence. Again, gunshot wounds, beatings and again burnt alive in their own homes.
Well, apparently, I know it's been hard sometimes to get a really clear picture of what's gone on in that particular area. But what do you think the international community can do to help some of the people that have been victims of this violence?
Well, what we can do immediately is assistance that we're providing to those Rohingya refugees that are currently in the camps. And what I can say to you now is that the situation is still very precarious. I mean, of the top three things that we see in the camps right now, I mean, they're still living in terrible conditions. There are still issues with lack of just safe drinking water and sanitation in the camps right now. There's a high level of malnutrition that we see in the kids. And unfortunately, due to the fact that these settlements are overcrowded and the lack of routine immunization, we are starting to see outbreaks. We've seen measles outbreaks, and we're now seeing diphtheria outbreaks. So along with the Bangladeshi government and other international organizations, a lot of our focus has been on making sure that we can provide those basic assistance to the Rohingya populations in those camps. In terms of the broader issue around the Rohingya population, I mean, I think our role as MSF is, or one of our roles is to not only provide that assistance, but collect the data in a reliable and objective way and expose that to the world. And our hope is that governments, international organizations will take their responsibility and act.
Doctors Without Borders Medical Director Sidney Wong, the United Nations has described the reported actions carried out by Myanmar forces as, quote, a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. Happening now in Asia, Australia officials say a South Korean-born man has been arrested and charged with acting as an economic agent for North Korea, trying to broker a deal including weapons of mass destruction. Chan Han Choi is a naturalized Australian citizen arrested in Sydney, where he has lived for decades. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you've joined us on this Monday morning on VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made some public remarks last week indicating direct negotiations could take place with Pyongyang without precondition. The U.S. State Department later said the secretary was not creating new policy, that dialogue is possible only when North Korea is prepared for peaceful denuclearization. But the White House seemed to contradict Tillerson, saying a climate of improvement needed to be in place before any discussions could take place. Ken Goss, director of the International Affairs Group at the Washington-based Center for Naval Analysis, tells VOA he was pleased with Tillerson's statement and puzzled by the White House statement, appearing to undermine the secretary's remarks.
I think Secretary of State Tillerson has the right idea of needing to at least have no preconditions in place to possibly see if we can entice North Korea to the table, to have the beginnings of laying out a way forward in terms of engagement. I'm not sure the North Koreans would accept such an offer, but I definitely think that they are going to be very wary because they don't think that Secretary of State Tillerson has the ear of the White House right now.
Although the White House said no negotiations could occur until North Korea's behavior improves, Ken Goss says the length of time for such improvement seems ambiguous.
Well, we just had 75 days without missile tests until November 29th when they had a missile test. What were we doing then? I mean, how is North Korea and the international community to understand what the rules of the game here? We keep saying, don't test. Well, they didn't test. We didn't seem to engage. So I'm kind of confused about what the administration means by bad behavior. I think North Korea was purposely trying to test the waters over the last month to see what the U.S. might be willing to offer, but the U.S. was rather silent. And then North Korea conducts a test, and now we start the clock all over again. So it's becoming very confusing, I think, to understand what the U.S. policy is.
With winter months settling in, North Korea might curtail testing, and this could present an opportunity for the United States to give leader Kim Jong-un something in exchange for suspending his nuclear and missile activities. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Interpol has canceled the red corner notice it issued on the request of the Indian government against controversial Islamic scholar Zakir Naik, citing insufficient evidence against Naik on accusations of hate speech, promoting terrorism, and money laundering. Currently in Malaysia, Naik denies the charges. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, India has the world's largest Tibetan exile community, whose members have lived as stateless refugees for decades and helped keep the spotlight on the Tibetan struggle for more autonomy from China. But in recent months, some Tibetans are opting for Indian nationality following a Delhi High Court ruling that those born in India between 1950 and 1987 are Indian citizens by birth. Amid murmurs that this could weaken the Tibetan cause, Tibetan exiles say they cannot continue to live as stateless people. Anjana Pisricha tells us more from New Delhi.
Since taking Indian nationality 6 months ago, events organizer Lobsang Wangyal is relaxed when he travels abroad. Time-consuming exit permits and extra scrutiny at airports that Tibetan refugees routinely face are a distant memory.
You know, from the big queue, people like behind me, I'll be brought on the side and, you know, for questioning. It looks very, like, you know, feels very strange, you know, not nice, as if I have done something wrong or something, you know.
Wangyal's petition in the Delhi High Court for a passport has paved the way for many Tibetans to apply for Indian citizenship. Those born after 1987 must have an Indian parent, according to new laws. But that has raised questions of whether Indian nationality will loosen their identity and their commitment to the Dalai Lama's campaign for more Tibetan autonomy from China. Despite little progress, it remains a top priority, asserts Karten Sering, the head of the Residents Association in a Tibetan settlement in New Delhi.
Never will leave Free Tibet, what we call Free Tibet protest, or Free Tibet in our mind, in our heart, that our land is there.
Taking Indian nationality means the refugees who have registration certificates must move out of Tibetan settlements. Sering personally does not feel the need to take Indian citizenship.
In India, there is no any bar and no any restriction to what we call to do anything what we want, you know.
But a younger generation is getting restless. They want access to bank loans to establish roots and travel freely, rights that citizenship brings. An undergraduate student at Delhi University, 23-year-old Tenzin Paldon, longs to get citizenship, although she is not eligible. She wants to give wings to her dreams, maybe to migrate, but without a passport, she is stuck.
I think if I go to America, I can do work, I can do job, I can study, I can do anything I want. They're like freedom, I guess. It will make our life easier, I guess.
But she agonizes over a decision that some think amounts to giving up on the idea of returning to the Tibetan homeland.
So going against him is the moral, you know, moral issue, like inside us, not for all the people. I don't know what all think, but inside us we have this issue going, you know, from my brain and my heart.
Those who have taken Indian nationality assert that they're not betraying the Tibetan struggle, but accept the reality that India is the only home they know. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This news alert from VOA Asia. At least two heavily armed suicide bombers assaulted a crowded church in southwestern Pakistan, killing at least 9 worshippers from the minority Christian community. Police guards engaged the attackers, killing one of them, leading a second to blow himself up. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, television viewers across the United States are again watching advertisements sponsored by major tobacco companies. But these ads are quite different from the ones that were pulled from the airwaves nearly 50 years ago. Instead of attractive people enjoying a smoke, these ads lay out in plain text and narration the dangers of using tobacco. VOA's George Pudich narrates the details.
It took more than a decade for major U.S. tobacco companies to finally agree on the exact wording of the corrective statements ordered by courts to be aired on primetime television and printed in newspapers.
Cigarette companies intentionally design cigarettes with enough nicotine to create and sustain addiction.
They've created an ad that, frankly, isn't going to be all that compelling. It's, you know, black type scrolling on a white screen with kind of the most uninteresting voice, you know, you could possibly get.
Almost 500,000 people in the U.S. die each year from smoking-related diseases. That includes non-smokers regularly exposed to secondhand smoke. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also calculates the cost for medical care and lost productivity tops $300 billion a year. Aiming to recoup some of that money, the Clinton administration sued tobacco companies in 1999 for deceiving the public about the dangers of its use.
Today, on behalf of the taxpayer, we're asking the tobacco companies to pay their fair share.
The lawsuit ended in 2006 with a ruling that tobacco companies have to publish the corrective statements in newspapers and TV. Anti-smoking advocates say the effect will be minimal because the tobacco industry's target audience, teenagers and young adults, now watch advertisements mostly on social media, while older smokers have other reasons to continue smoking.
Smokers continue smoking not because they do not know much about the harmful effects of smoking, but because they have other various reasons, like just stress management or addiction effects of nicotine.
Tobacco use is declining in the U.S., but some experts say that has been offset by the rise of electronic cigarettes, which they say are as dangerous as the regular cigarettes. George Pudich, VOA News.
Lily pads, fish, and mussels of the electronic variety are being deployed in and out of the canals of Venice. It's part of a project designed to monitor the water quality of the watery city. VOA's Kevin Enix dives into the details.
This is the A fish and the A mussel and the A pad. They are unique robots that make up part of a four-year, nearly $5 million project to monitor the health of the water surrounding Venice.
Subcultron is a collective artificial intelligence project whose aim is to create the biggest shoal of robot fish in the world. The aim of the project is to improve knowledge of the seabed and, from a technological point of view, to try to transfer human abilities to high-tech items.
The robots live at all levels of the canals and work together to constantly monitor Venetian water quality.
A mussels that lie on the seabed collect data. They send this data to the A fish, who transfer the data to the A pads. The A pads act as a communication bridge with us researchers. The A fish can also collect data on their own, and the A pads can also recharge all the other devices under the sea.
The project is being run by Europe's Institute for Marine Science. The idea is that the robots will do remote what these researchers now have to do by hand.
The health status of the lagoon is pretty good. There are no industrial polluters, and the city now has a modern sewer system. It's not like before when all the sewers flushed directly into the water.
Not only will the robots monitor the water quality, as time goes by and the artificial intelligence gets smarter, the bots will also be on the lookout for invasive species and any kinds of changes in the water, like new and unusual sources of pollution. The robots will be swimming around Venice until 2019, but bots like this could someday be deployed all over the world's oceans. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and many of you are listening on the radio, like Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines and Media Biz Radio, Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks to everyone who joined us through the airwaves. You can also find us at VOA Asia Facebook and streaming on voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, John Ellison, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.